C-158. Number 8B.
Little by little, you see, through these four chapters, the sense of duality, the latent sense of duality in the reader is slowly resolved through these four chapters until the reader himself is sitting down on the throne of grace at the end of the fourth chapter, and then from there can look out to the four following chapters on the Christ and reign with God. And from that point begins, taking the standpoint of God, begins to translate every other false standpoint back into the true standpoint. That's what we have then in science, theology, and medicine, where every false standpoint, the standpoint of mortal mind, is translated into the standpoint of divine mind, where the standpoint of matter is translated into the standpoint of spirit, where the standpoint of the physical sense testimony is translated into the standpoint of soul, where the standpoint of physical science and natural science is translated into the standpoint of the principle, and then in the fifth, where the standpoint of theology is translated into the standpoint of science of life, and then in the sixth, where the standpoint of medicine and material saving and material saver is translated back into the true standpoint of the Savior of truth, finishing up the whole thing and saying, now you have the true standpoint. Now you have no more two universes, which either you have to separate or to reconcile. You have one universe. And that naturally leads to the chapter on physiology, which says, therefore you only have one man, and it resolves in the first part mortal mentality to nothing, and in the second part brings to light the one man. And so we have footsteps of truth, which shows, all right, and everything is consciousness. Then it translates the false pillar of consciousness into the true pillar of consciousness, and so shows there is only one consciousness. So, little by little, you see, we see how there is something enormously gentle about the textbook story. It isn't a line which is humanly conceived, but is a line which is in itself coherent and which is principled. It's not an individual way of salvation. It's the principle of salvation. It is not one of the many possible ways of salvation. It shows the principle of salvation. And therefore, man being individual, meaning inseparable from God, has jolly well to submit himself to this principle. He can't sidestep the law and the order and the rule and the system. That's his method. If he obeys to the law and to the order and to the rule and to the system laid down, that is his method of life. And that method of life always brings the new man, brings to birth in us the new man. And when the new man is born into us, we rejoice in the seventh day in beauty and bounty. Well, I have still made some notes for some more 2 or 3 hours. Because when one sits over these chapters, you see, what we have been doing is that we first had, through earnest study, to look at the text a bit more meticulously, in order to see that we grasp the true meaning of what Mrs. Eddy wanted to say with each subject. Find it out truly. Have we got the tone? Have we got the subject right? But once we have done these 2 years' work together, then naturally we can, you say, browse over it? Browse over it. I think that's Peggy's favorite expression. Very good expression. Browse over it and say, what does it all mean? And just to go over it again and over it again, not in a repetitive sense, but always with an inspired sense, always with an inquiring sense, always inquiring again, say, well, how do these things belong together? How do these things fit together? What do they mean? What do they want to achieve? Where do they want us to arrive to? See, where do they want to bring us to? And as one ponders these and prays over it, one begins to see quite deep things, which may not be written black on white in the text, but which come as a further embellishment or a further unfoldment of what is written in the text. Now, if I can't leave you alone before I have said something which matters, and that is this. The question may now be, do I have first to know properly and completely the first chapter? And only when I know that, can I then go to the second chapter and then to the third? And I would say no. The whole thing is one big rhythm. And we always get a better view on a chapter when we know all the other chapters. Then we always get the better perspective of one chapter. And so I would say that it is important to work along a direct line, that there is no excellence without labor in a direct line, and that we shouldn't scatter the fire. But from time to time, I think it's even necessary, even important, to broaden out one's view again and say, now, what position, what message has this chapter or these four chapters within the whole of metaphysics? Say, within the whole textbook, within the relation of the Bible and the textbook, within the whole. And so, from time to time, I think it's even necessary, in order to always get the overall picture, sometimes to ask, well, how does that story go on? What comes afterwards? What is the line that is coming afterwards? And so, I would say it is quite good that from time to time one looks at the other chapters, perhaps not so much with that same interest, with that same investigating mind as the chapter in which one is at the present working, but that one always rounds up the whole thing, that from time to time the Bible again comes into focus, that if one sees the parallels that exist between the Bible and the textbook, and so that one doesn't get too narrow in thinking that because I have said, and because I see that there is only excellence coming out if working in a direct line, that isn't taken again too narrow. Let's be a bit tender and flexible about this thing. And then too, even if we work, say, within the first four or five chapters, even if we work within those chapters, let's see that all the chapters are always one. Because let's say we are working in the chapter on animal magnetism and are working out something of handling evil. Let's say we are handling evil. Well, that handling evil is really only handling evil when it is built, on the foundation of the first four chapters. The handling of evil is just nothing if it isn't imbued with the tone of prayer. Just nothing. It's just words. That ending of evil of the fifth chapter must be imbued with prayer, with the attitude of prayer. And it must be imbued, say, without prayer it would have no substance. It must be imbued, say, with the attitude of atonement Eucharist, because without that we just handle evil without being willing to let evil go. We just handle evil because we think that's a very comfortable and easy way of getting rid of evil, but without the willingness in us, atonement Eucharist, without the willingness in us to let really evil go, which we handle, that handling of evil will not do a job. And without the standpoint of marriage coupled with it, which says, all right, I handle evil with prayer, with a prayerful attitude, with a willingness to let evil go, and I jolly well try to do that whenever an opportunity arises, that's marriage, where I contribute in every human circumstances not to let evil have the upper hand, can you say that? The upper hand on me. So it must be coupled with that. And it must jolly well be coupled with the sense of the fourth chapter on Christian Science versus Spiritualism, where we see that this handling of evil is not a ritual, that it is not a schematic thing, but that the handling of evil is touching the very core of science. That science which is shown in the fourth chapter as that which is bringing every sense of belief to naught. That this science, that handling of evil, is working within the realm of a science which has all the power and the presence and the omnipresence of the science. So can you see that we can never take one chapter out of the whole and consider this as a unit by itself and say, now I handle it only from this chapter. We never can. We would tear to pieces the robe of Christ. We would part the garment. And so that must always be one, you see. And then a student may say this, but that's an enormous job. They would say, all right, if I have a problem, then I must first go through the first subject of prayer, then the second subject of prayer, then the third subject of prayer, and then I am through prayer, I must go to the first subject of atonement of Eucharist, and so on and so on, and then, well, he sees one big mountain and he feels that he crashes under it. Now, the point is, let me take an analogy. Perhaps you remember Mr. Dawley when he used to say, when he was talking about the synonyms, that he used to say, well, in earlier times, he said, perhaps, when I was thinking about mind, I was thinking about power and about action and about law, about cause and origin and authority and beginning and the light and so on. And then he would go on and say, but today I just think mind. And so with the other synonyms. Well, what he wanted to show is this, that at the beginning of a subject, when begins to think about the very details of that subject, like about law and power and force and action and origin and all and the light, about the ideas of mind, you see. But that, little by little, as one cultures that, one frees oneself of terms, of words, and becomes a tone. And a tone means mind. And when he had the tone of mind in consciousness, he had in that mind was comprised in one go, so to say, all the ideas of mind. Well, the same thing is true in every other thing. If we learn to drive a car, we first learn how to steer, and then after a while, perhaps we learn how to do the gears, see, and then after a while we do a third one, with perhaps the clutches that we have to do with the gears, and then perhaps the indicators, manage the indicators, and so on, one thing after the other. But finally we just drive and talk with it, and talk besides that. We just drive, you see. It's no more, I have to steer and I have to do the gears and I have to put the clutch and now I have to put out the indicator and I have to put the light and must see if there is enough fuel in it. It's just driving. See, it has become one thing. The many component parts of driving has become one thing, driving. Just as through spiritual culture, Mr. Dolly would have said, the many component parts of mind, through considering them, pondering them, loving them, little by little they have become mind. Well, the same thing will be happening with the chapters. That these chapters, in the beginning, what we have been doing is first to analyze and to view from all sides, you see, from all sides, what prayer means. From the side of the seven subjects, from the side of the overtone, from the side of the oneness, and so on. But finally, one just gets an attitude which is called prayer. And so it is with atonement and Eucharist. One analyzes and says, what does it mean, what does it involve, what does it demand, and so on, and so on. And if one cultures that earnestly through years, 2 years and so on, finally it becomes just an attitude, which is atonement and Eucharist. And so with each chapter, you see. So that when I say that each chapter must always really be in correlation and in unity, be considered with all the other chapters, it isn't that we have to read through the whole whole textbook, but that little by little there is an attitude which is developed in oneself which comprises in one go all the details. And as we see, you see, that really not one chapter can stand alone by itself, that each chapter is only doing its proper job insofar as it is considered in relation to all the other chapters. Naturally, we see that each chapter really is a textbook by its own. Or as Mr. Sinton always has shown you, that each chapter really is a matrix of its own. That the textbook viewed, that the whole textbook viewed from the point of view, that the whole 16 of the textbook viewed from the point of view of prayer, give a little, I can't say a little matrix, give a matrix sense, but viewed from prayer. And so atonement can be seen because it is atonement which needs all other chapters to be full atonement. Is also in itself holding all the 16. So you see how Mr. Sinton's presentation of this chapter in the 16 is only the natural consequence of seeing the oneness of the textbook. Now, has anybody to go on a train now? Well, the only point I want to touch is the sabbatical year. So those who have to go now won't miss very much. But I like to say a word or two that I felt in my bones that it is time to stop these talks, and so that one can have take a little bit breath, so to say, and instead of pushing on and pushing on until one is out of breath, to give a certain time within which one can adjust oneself to the need of the hour. And what that need of the hour is, that I can't say, because it's perhaps a bit because it is individual for each one. Not everyone is in the same position, not everyone has done the same amount of study or so during the last thing. And also, so that I can't say, let's use this year or so for this and this. Quite apart from the fact that I know that English people never like to be regimented, whereas if I would give these talks in Berlin or so, I think they would be very glad if I would say, now for the next 2 months you are going to do this and the further 2 months that. So if I like that you do really a job, I must not tell you to do the job. It has taken me 10 years to come to this insight. But all this is really not necessary, because if I have been able to give a sense of what prayer is, then everybody knows what to do. Because then in prayer, everyone will get the answer, which is God's blessing for the hour and for the individual. But just the same, I would say this. But I don't consider this sabbatical year as an opportunity to put away all what one has done and to let it go dry in one's consciousness, but that it should, that as the seventh day always is, it's a day of rest, but it is a day of active rest. God rests in action, and I felt to stop here at the fifth chapter, because the sixth chapter starts with quite a different attitude. It says, God had been graciously preparing me during many years for the reception of this final revelation of the Absolute Principle. Why didn't she say that at the beginning of the textbook? She didn't say that in the beginning, because as I see it, that what she shows in these first five chapters is the gracious preparing for revelation. The word chapters have taught us and presented us the way how to go and be pushed on the throne of God. From where the whole universe is revealed and no more taught and presented. From now on, we have much more to do with revelation than with presentation. And the revelation never comes into our consciousness until our consciousness is pure enough to let the light shine through. So I felt very much in my bones that I can't teach the sixth chapter. I can't teach it. I just feel I can't teach it as I have done it. That the sixth chapter asks of us that somehow we feel to be graciously prepared through the first five chapters to that standpoint where we just are transparent for the revelation. And out of this reason, I felt I would give at least a year or so time to go over the ground again, the one more, the one less, that's individual, but I just would say that I would like to take up these meetings only then when there is a feeling that one is graciously prepared through the first five chapters to let the light shine in. And that each one has to decide for himself when that moment comes and when he feels or she feels to be prepared for that. And so I can't give any line of what to do except to do something divinely. And so I want to stop here and thank you again for the opportunity of sharing what is being born to this age. It was a lovely time. Goodbye.